The sun will set this evening at 7:40. It'll rise tomorrow morning at 6:08. Current temperatures include 54 in both Kenosha and Lake Geneva. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be hearing from the author of a new book called The Gratitude Diaries, a book which talks about how life can be so much better for us. We can be so much happier, have a much stronger sense of well-being if we live with more gratitude. In part two of the program, we're going to be hearing something about fear and some strategies for keeping fear from being too dominant a force in your life. An appropriate topic given the jittery fears on stock markets across the country. As a matter of fact, we're going to preempt the very end of the morning show today in order to rejoin National Public Radio for today's latest edition of Marketplace Update to take a look at what's going on with stocks around the world. So stay with us for all of that in this next hour here on WGTD-HD. Next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we are going to be talking about gratitude. Gratitude is one of those words that is much bandied about, and yet in many instances we really don't stop to think about it, about its importance, and we certainly don't always take the time to be concerted about weaving true gratitude into our daily lives. Janice Kaplan embarked on a year-long journey to become more grateful, to weave gratitude into her daily life. At the time that she began this, she was a relatively happy and very successful person, someone who had enjoyed great success as a television producer, writer, best-selling author, and yet somehow she felt that something was missing, which kept her from maybe fully appreciating life and all of its beauty. What was missing was the deepest kind of gratitude. So for a year, she not only looked at her own life and ways in which she could herself become more grateful, but also looked at many of the studies that have been done about gratitude and its tangible effect on people's well-being. And so the book which resulted from all of that, called The Gratitude Diaries, is not only a chronicle of her own personal journey, but also a collection of a lot of collective wisdom on the topic of gratitude, what it is to be grateful, and the difference that gratitude can make in our lives. The full story of the book is The Gratitude Diaries, How a Year Looking on the Bright Side Can Transform Your Life, published by Dutton. Janice Kaplan is well-known for a number of different professional accomplishments, including a long tenure as editor-in-chief of Parade magazine, at the time the most widely circulated magazine in the country. She was co-author of a previous bestseller called I'll See You Again. Again, her newest book is called The Gratitude Diaries. Janice Kaplan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I am very, very happy about this opportunity indeed. So explain to our listeners a little bit more about your state of mind at the time when you decided that gratitude needed to be more a part of your life. From what you write about yourself at that point in time, you weren't a particularly negative person, I don't think. And yet somehow you've found that there was, in a sense, something wanting in your life. Describe what your state of being was at the time and in a sense, what you thought was missing.
Well, I think you described it beautifully in the introduction that all of us need something a little bit deeper in our lives, and we tend to think that it's going to be the events of our lives that will make us happy. And from so much of the research that I had done on for other projects, I knew that that just wasn't true. That once we achieve something, it becomes what we expect. Psychologists refer to it as habituation. That you get something, you want something, and you want it, and then you achieve it. Whether it's a great job, whether it's a marriage or a shiny new car, you have it and then you stop noticing it because it becomes the baseline. And then you start wanting the next thing and you start wanting something more. And professionally, I had really certainly had achieved a lot. I appreciated that and my personal life all was fine. But I think some of us just spend a lot of time always wondering what the next step is going to be and what's going to come along that's going to be really more terrific than what we already have. And maybe next year that great thing will strike and I'll be more satisfied. And I realized that what I needed to do was to change my attitude, not wait for something to happen. And so I challenged myself to spend that year living gratefully, and that's what led to the Gratitude Diaries.
One thing that you just described reminds me of a very important point, which I think you made, that a lot of people who read this book and or hear this interview have busy lives in the professional world, and if they are successful, they have achieved that success, at least in part, because of their own sense of ambition. And more than once in the book, you sort of point out something I'd never really stopped to think about before, namely that sense of ambition can be one of the trickiest complications when it comes to being grateful, to being satisfied. How does one reconcile being satisfied with what you have, feeling like what you have or what you've accomplished is enough, versus being ambitious to achieve still more?
Well, it's a great question, and it's exactly what I worried about as I started the year, because I thought, okay, if I end up the year and gratitude is just something platitudinous that makes you say, oh, everything is fine, all is well, that's not going to be a success, because that's not who I am. And so I knew that gratitude had to be something that really worked with the rest of my life and with the fact that I wanted to appreciate what I have, but that didn't mean I wanted to be patted on the back and told, either literally or metaphorically, and told that everything was okay. So I was very happy to start doing some of the research and to find out that in many studies, people who are grateful actually end up being more successful because what gratitude does is it makes you happier about your life. And when you're happier about your life and when you're excited about what you're doing, you get up earlier in the morning and you're looking for other things and you're filled with excitement and energy. And really that's what I found gratitude did for me. And, you know, I live in New York, so I have lots of edgy friends who really worried that I was going to end up being so happy sappy at the end of this year that they wouldn't be able to talk to me. And instead I think they were quite taken by discovering how well gratitude does work in even for the most ambitious people, and in helping us go on. Another really interesting fact about gratitude at work is that a lot of bosses think that they shouldn't say thanks to the people who work for them. You hear that grumbling, oh, we say thank you with a paycheck. Well, they couldn't be more wrong. People are motivated by being appreciated. We all want to be appreciated. There was one study out of the London School of Economics that looked at research in the field over many years, and they found that the number one motivator on the job was actually being appreciated. And for bosses, in that same survey that I had done, we found that people who are grateful are more likely to be successful because the people they work for will rally around them, and none of us succeed on our own. We actually need the people there who are going to help us.
We're speaking with Janice Kaplan about her new book called The Gratitude Diaries: How a Year Looking on the Bright Side Can Transform Your Life. So of course some people who might come to the same realization that I need to be more grateful, I need to have more gratitude in my life, would just sort of start to try to be more grateful in a fairly sort of nebulous, open-ended fashion. You didn't go about it that way at all. You decided instead that this would be a year-long project broken up by a focus on different facets of gratitude, different things to be grateful about month by month by month. Is that just who you are? And did that fit kind of your own personal matrix of your personality and values, or do you think that is a valuable framework that just about everybody should adopt for themselves in terms of becoming more grateful?
Well, yes and yes. I think, first of all, for me, it worked very well because I'm a journalist, and I need to do things in an orderly way and to have support for what I'm doing. I didn't want it to just be my year. I really wanted this year to be supported by research, by interviews, by explanations for what was happening. So the book is very grounded in information that people can use. But I also think that it's important for us to do things to take particular steps and to know that we're going to do something specific. Somebody said to me that gratitude isn't a feeling, gratitude is an action. And I really loved that because we can sit around and sort of think, oh, I'm grateful, but unless we express it to somebody or we write it down or we do something that shows it, we're not going to get the full effects from it. So I think taking it on in a serious way, even by doing something as simple as keeping a gratitude journal, writing down one thing every day that makes you grateful, will help you focus on doing it.
You actually ended up beginning this journey of gratitude very much at home, first with your own husband and then with your two sons, in terms of appreciating them more and I think along the way hoping that they might also become more appreciative and grateful along the way. But as you describe them, it sounds like in many respects both your husband and both of your two sons had a lot going for them already in terms of generally speaking being very grateful people. And maybe in some ways you had something to learn from them about what gratitude really was.
Very perceptive, yes. I sometimes think my older son is much more mature than I am. I think as my kids are grown up now, but when they were younger, we used to, once a week, we tried to have dinner together as often as we could, but at least once a week, we always had a family dinner on a Friday night, and we would start that dinner by the line was something good that happened. And it was just something good that had happened in the course of that week, and everybody would talk about it. And I realized later that that was that was a gratitude lesson. That was a way of instilling in them the sense of, yeah, we can, you know, we can spend a lot of time talking about all the terrible things that happen when you're in fourth grade, but once a week at least we're going to pause and say, let's look at all of the good things that happened. And perhaps that instilled something in them and gave them the ability to reframe situations so that they wanted to, it became natural to them. You know, kids don't know to be grateful unless you help them because they don't have anything to compare it to. They have one life, and probably most of their friends' lives are not too dissimilar from theirs. So reminding kids not to just think about what they don't have, but to think about what they do have can really make a big difference for them. With my husband, I had been married a long time, and I'm married to a really great guy, and I stopped noticing that, and I think that a lot of us do that. A lot of us, just the person that we're supposed to love most in the whole world becomes the background to our lives rather than somebody that we pay attention to. And that didn't seem right. So the very first month of my year, I devoted to my husband, and I devoted to trying to say thank you to him every day and trying to appreciate him. And it comes back in spades. He started noticing. I didn't make a big deal of it. I didn't even tell him what I was doing because at the beginning I wasn't completely sure what I was doing. But he noticed it. And then he started appreciating me. And then he started thanking me for the things that I normally do. And the whole vibe between us started to change. And I think we started to trust each other more. We got much closer. And at the end of that year, we both said that for no particular reason, nothing dramatic had happened that year. We'd not had any big life event, but somehow it had been the best year together that we'd ever had. And we certainly wanted to see if we can keep that going.
As you enlarge the circle of this journey to involve other people in your life and then your sphere of work and matters like health and so on, at one point you realize that, in your words, the one downside to the positivity that I suddenly was that you suddenly found yourself excessively sensitive to people who weren't grateful. That is something which probably would not have registered at all once upon a time. You suddenly became much more aware of, that is, those all around you who tended to focus on the negative that rather than the positive and not being particularly grateful for the good things in their lives. How did you end up dealing with that hypersensitivity to ungratefulness or ingratitude that was all around you?
It's very interesting, and it's an interesting topic that you bring up because it did happen, and it happened with a close friend who is a wonderful person, but does tend to be somebody who will always find what's wrong. And we were out to dinner one night, and she was telling me all of the terrible things about her job. And I had, by that point, changed my focus on things, and so I was trying to point it out to her. I was saying, yes, but you know, you still have a job, first of all. You actually love your job. And her complaint was that her job had moved to a place that was difficult to get to, and she didn't like her commute, and she didn't like her new office. So I was trying to point out, but it's not such a terrible commute, and you still love the people you work with. And you know, there were, needless to say, there were a list of 10 good things. And she was so mired in seeing the negative that she couldn't get out of that. And I went home so frustrated that evening and told my husband I didn't think I could still be friends with her. But somehow I think the conversation and my perspective and what I was trying to say to her finally did hit. And she called me a couple of days later, and she remarked on something else that she was grateful about. And she said, you know, I was thinking about what you said, and she told me another story and something that wasn't work-related but that had made her grateful. And I was so happy to realize that that you can make inroads. No matter who you are, you can start to change. And maybe it's not going to happen the first day, and maybe it's not going to happen on the one topic that's most frustrating to you. But I think the nice thing about gratitude is that it spreads. And one of the pleasures for me of writing the gratitude diaries and talking to people about it is that everybody I would tell that I was writing about this book, they would say, oh, yeah, I need to be more grateful. Or, oh, yeah, I've been thinking about that. It's really something that I should do. I think somewhere we all understand just how important this is. And what I'm really excited about with the Gratitude Diaries is that I hope it can, it's fun, and it's fun to read, and that it tells my story as well as other research, and that I hope it then will inspire people to figure out how they can do that in their own lives. It's not a particular formula. I'm not saying you have to do X, Y, or Z. I'm saying it's so much in your control. And that's one of the great pleasures of gratitude, is that it gives you that sense of, I can control being happy. I don't have to wait for something to happen. I can make myself happy. And I think that's pretty exciting for all of us to realize.
Say a quick word about how this left you transformed once this year-long project was over. I mean, that very next day, did you find yourself living exactly as you had during this year-long project?
Well, you know, I had the great, great pleasure of getting to live this book as my work, and getting to make gratitude part of my work. So, of course, I slipped back a little bit in the 6-8 months since that year ended. But it has become so much a part of my life, and I'll give you a very specific example that I've not shared yet because it just happened. The book was coming out this week, and this past weekend I was a little anxious about it, you know. And I woke up and I thought, I know this book should have an impact, and I want people to read it, and will it happen? And I was going to be on the Today Show, and I was going to be doing these radio shows, and so I was really worried. And I went out for a walk, and I started thinking, wait a minute. What are you grateful for? And I paused and I thought how grateful I was that I got to write this book, and how grateful I was that people were going to read it and maybe be able to change their lives. And as I walked, it just completely changed how I felt, and the anxiety just slipped away. And I thought, I hope the future is great, and I hope this does well, but if it doesn't, I'm okay, because the moment and the experience to do it was great, and I'm grateful for that. And so I hope that's what gratitude can do for us. It can make us say, we still want a lot for the future, but hey, I'm going to stop right now and say this moment is pretty good in itself.
It reminds me of one of my favorite sayings about gratitude: if we pause to think, we will have cause to thank.
That's lovely.
And I think your book is lovely. It's called The Gratitude Diaries, How a Year Looking on the Bright Side Can Transform Your Life, published by Dutton. Janice Kaplan, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about your most intriguing and valuable book. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
The time is 8:32, coming up on 8:33. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Next, a conversation about fear. And towards the end of the hour, we're going to rejoin National Public Radio for today's Marketplace Update and take a look at the jittery markets all around the world. Stay with us for the Morning Show on WGTD. We talk today about fear, but more important even than talking about fear, we will talk about some ways in which you can confront any fear issues which you might have in your life. And a lot of people have fear issues. In fact, some statistics suggest fully 1/4 of all Americans have or will have what we would call an anxiety disorder. And as our guest, Dr. David Tolan, is going to explain, this makes it a problem which actually dwarfs things such as depression or substance abuse. I mean, there are so many of us walking around with these issues, and in many cases with issues so severe that our lives are adversely affected, and the lives of those around us, those we care about and who care about us. Dr. David Tolan is a well-known psychologist, psychiatrist, and director and founder of the Institute of Living, and specifically at the Anxiety Disorders Center. And some of his colleagues there have collaborated with him in his most recent book, which is called Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions, a book published by John Wiley and Sons. Dr. Tolan is taking aim at a very important and complex topic, and trying to help us come to terms with the role that excessive fear might have in our lives. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak with him. And by the way, the name Dr. David Tolan may be familiar to you from some different television programs he has been associated with, such as the OCD Project and the A&E series Hoarders. And he's been on a lot of other programs as well, sharing his expertise. Dr. David Tolan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Nice to be with you.
Look forward to this very much. I was really staggered by the statistic quoted in your book, that one that I mentioned about a quarter of Americans having, or at some point in their lives, having an anxiety disorder. I wonder if you could just say a word about how much this is a peculiarly American phenomenon.
I wish I could say that it was, but it actually turns out that this is a worldwide phenomenon, and this has been detected, by the World Health Organization, who, lists, their leading causes of illness-related disability. And time again, anxiety disorders rank right up there near the top. This really is the most common mental health problem in the United States and probably worldwide, both in terms of the number of people who suffer from them, as well as to the economic impact of those disorders.
One of the things you do in your book is you express some reservations. I almost said disdain. I think that's would be putting it a bit too strongly. But you have some reservations about the way in which fear is often discussed, and particularly the way in which it is often categorized in rather what appears to be very sophisticated scientific fashion. And you actually lay out your book acknowledging those categorizations, but actually choosing to talk about this in your own terms, in categories which you describe as, in a sense, simpler and maybe kind of more intuitive. Talk a moment about your concerns about the way we frame our discussions and understandings of fear and what you've done in this book instead.
Sure. Well, we get the names for these disorders from a volume that comes out every few years that's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM. It's published by the American Psychiatric Association, and in the anxiety disorders, it lists a number of diagnoses. And these might be things that people have heard of before. They're things like panic disorder and obsessive-compulsive disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, phobias. And those labels are fine, but if you are trying to do something about the problem, they don't necessarily lend themselves very well to kind of intuitively understanding what it is that you need to do. So I thought, really what makes much more sense is to break fear down into what the person is afraid of and why. And what we see is that those categories are much fewer in number, and they overlap across various things that are within the anxiety disorders, as well as in some things that are not listed in the anxiety disorders, but I think perhaps should be.
I love the fact that your book actually opens with a brief little anecdote about yourself, mm-hmm. something to the effect that as you were penning those particular words, you happened to be on an airplane mm-hmm. and freely acknowledge a bit of anxiety of your own in that moment. I don't remember if you were in takeoff or landing or in mid-flight, but I wonder if you could just say a word about your real-life experiences with fear.
Sure. Well, it was kind of fortuitous because I was having writer's block. I knew the book that I wanted to write, and I was on an airplane at the time, and I had my laptop open, and I was sitting here racking my brain, thinking, I know what I want to write, but I don't know how to start the book. What do I write? And then all of a sudden the captain comes on and says, we're about to experience severe turbulence, buckle up. And the plane started, you know, pitching, and I paid attention to what I was thinking and feeling and doing on that flight, and then thought, ah, I think I know how I'm going to start the book. And I just started by describing what was happening to me on this flight. Now, I'm not a phobic of flights, but I was experiencing fear, which is a universal human emotion. It's my guess is that most of the people on the plane were experiencing that to some degree. But I broke it down into talking about what does that mean biologically? What happens to the body when somebody experiences fear? And I talked about what happens mentally when somebody is experiencing fear. What kinds of things do they think about, and how do they think and process information? And then I talked about it behaviorally. So what does somebody do when they feel anxious as a way of trying to feel better, and does that work, or does that contribute to the problem? And it turns out that actually the very kinds of experiences I was having there on that airplane in turbulence are precisely the same things that we talk to our anxiety disordered patients and clients about. We talk to them about what those bodily sensations mean and the role of your thinking and your own actions in causing the fear to persist.
I wonder, as you put this book together, what sorts of pitfalls you wanted to avoid, because you acknowledge the fact that mountains of books about fear have been written, some of which you find to be well-written books and
sure,
worthwhile books, and which you, I think, acknowledge even more specifically. But there's also been a lot of poor and not particularly helpful stuff written about fear.
Right.
What were you most anxious to avoid as you put this book together?
I was trying to strike a balance here. And as you mentioned, Greg, there are a lot of really very well-written self-help books about how to deal with anxieties and fears and anxiety disorders. And I'm a big fan of them, and I even recommend them by name in the book. However, the problem with those is generally that they are too narrow. That is, they only are written to apply to one very specific DSM anxiety disorder. And they don't tell you what to do about other forms of anxiety. And the problem is, of course, most people with anxiety disorders actually have multiple kinds of anxiety. They have multiple fears. So unless you want to buy an entire shelf worth of books, it's very hard to find one comprehensive guide that sort of tells you how to do it. Now, the other books that are out there that are broadly written, that is, they're written to help people with anxiety disorder, many of them are chock full of misinformation and actually could steer readers down the wrong path into things that I think are frankly unhelpful, at the very least don't have any scientific support behind them, or in some cases may even be harmful or dangerous.
Speaking of that, your book includes a questionnaire in which the reader is invited to answer a number of different questions about themselves and the sorts of things which set off their own fears. And it helps a reader to potentially place themselves within the framework of the different types of fear that you address.
Mm-hmm.
But what I especially appreciate about your questionnaire are sort of the points of clarification which follow it, because it underscores the fact that any kind of a questionnaire, no matter how carefully you put it together, is still a relatively blunt and not all that sophisticated sort of instrument,
mm-hmm,
that so easily can be misused. I mean, that, for instance, somebody can end up convincing themselves that they have a terribly serious disorder, or
mm-hmm,
or in other ways, I mean, act on the questionnaire and its results in an inappropriate way. I so
yeah,
appreciate the fact that you have, in a sense, some disclaimers and some points of clarification that really will help the reader, I think, to use this questionnaire properly.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'm really steering away from, and I think it's in the spirit of the whole program, is I'm steering away from trying to diagnose people. It doesn't mean there's no place for diagnosis in the business, but in this context, you know, I didn't want people to come up with, you know, read the questionnaire and come away thinking, aha, this questionnaire tells me I have OCD, because that's not really an appropriate role for a self-administered questionnaire. If you really want to be diagnosed and know what the DSM label for your condition is, you have to go and talk to a specialist. However, if the issue is that you're experiencing fear, then all we need to do is start to understand what kind of fear that is. And so that's really what the questionnaire is aiming to do. And from there, we break it down, and people can categorize themselves into one or more of several categories of fear. These are not diagnoses. These are just descriptive statements about what are you afraid of. And some people are afraid of specific situations or objects or activities. Now, this could be things like, you know, snakes, spiders, high places, elevators, and so on. Some people are afraid of body sensations. That is, they're afraid of physiological sensations that come from inside their body, which they then believe to mean something, you know, is very medically wrong, or that they're going to have a disastrous attack of some kind. And some people will have social and performance fears. That is, they're primarily afraid of having to interact or perform in front of other people, and they're afraid that they're going to be humiliated or embarrassed. And there are some people who have excessive worrying. That is, they tell themselves nightmare scenarios about bad things that could happen in the future. And finally, there are some people who have what we might call post-traumatic fears. That is, they develop fears because something awful happened to them, and part of what they start to become afraid of are the memories of the event itself. And by simply using that framework, it helps lead the reader to what I think is a much more intuitive plan for, if I can categorize my fear this way, then I can develop a step-by-step plan to show me exactly what I need to do about it.
We're speaking with Dr. David Tolan and talking about his book, Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions. The bedrock of what you write about in your book is exposure therapy, which is a means by which, in careful fashion, someone ultimately is exposed to that to which they are so fearful. Mm-hmm. In a careful process of sort of realizing life doesn't end, the ceiling doesn't crash in, mm-hmm. just because you hold that piece of soap or whatever it is that is causing you such anxiety. Mm-hmm. You tell us mm-hmm. that exposure therapy is woefully underutilized in yes. clinical practice.
Yeah.
Why would that be?
Well, I think that there's several reasons for it, and one of which is that it is still not nearly as widely taught to mental health practitioners as would be reasonable. You know, we are still, I think that what we're seeing is kind of the dawning of a new age in mental health care, one that is much more carefully and rigorously based on the science of human emotion and cognition and behavior. I think what we end up with is for a lot of mental health practitioners, what is being taught and used is not terribly scientifically valid, and what is scientifically valid tends not to be taught and used. You know, and so what you find actually is that when you go to a mental health professional, and that could be a psychologist, it could be a psychiatrist, a social worker, a licensed professional counselor. If you have an anxiety disorder, the two most likely things you are likely to get are talking therapy and medications. Those are the most commonly used treatments. And the fact of the matter is that the medications are okay, but probably not great. The talking therapy really hasn't been shown to help all that much with anxiety disorders. It may feel good to go and talk to a counselor, but in terms of actually making the anxiety disorder get better, it doesn't seem to do that. There are actually some things you need to do in order to overcome a fear, and those principles are rooted in exposure therapy. You have to disrupt the cycle of avoidance and start to confront successfully the things that you're afraid of.
As is your book, Face Your Fears, A Proven Plan to Beat Anxiety, Panic, Phobias, and Obsessions, published by John Wiley and Sons. Dr. David Tolan, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for writing this book. I can see how it would be tremendously helpful to many, many people. I'm glad we could discuss it today on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
It's 8:49 here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Because of events on Wall Street, we're going to be preempting the end of the morning show in order to rejoin National Public Radio for the latest updates from Marketplace. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Quick word about tomorrow's morning show. I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Mark Rosian, who is a friend and colleague of Dr. Oz of television fame. Together, they have written a book which is called Stay Young, which offers all kinds of tangible advice for people wanting to remain as healthy as possible for as long as possible. So that conversation will be coming up on tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Sunshine right now at our WGTD studios, but we have increasing clouds in the forecast, a high today of just 70 degrees, and our winds will be out of the west at 15 to 20 miles per hour. Cloudy skies overnight are expected with a low of 52 degrees. Right now, though, dry conditions expected Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday with a slight warming trend expected, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms by Friday. That's the first time that we're likely to see a high temperature of 80 degrees. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. The time is 8:51 as we rejoin National Public Radio.
A few minutes ago, the Dow was down over 1,000 points, but it's recovered some.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Epson. Epson Smart Point of Sale Solutions offers a new class of mobility to retail sales designed for improved customer service. Where there's business, there's Epson. And by Angie's List, with reviews of local companies to help users buy services and achieve their goals of remodeled kitchens, freshly painted houses, or new backyards. Angie'sList.com.
From Marketplace, I'm David Brancaccio. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 4.3% at the moment, 710 points. You should know that about 15 minutes ago, the Dow had fallen 1,089 points. That was a 6.6% drop for that moment. That's not even close to the largest percentage drop in history, but it is the largest intraday point drop ever. S&P 500 is currently down 5.25%. The NASDAQ Composite is down 4.5%. The catalyst for today's drop may be the Chinese stock market, with Chinese state media is calling today Black Monday. Chinese shares sank to new lows this morning, wiping out all of this year's gains on the Shanghai market. The composite index there closed down 8.5% as investors worried about the effects of a slowdown inside the second largest economy, China's, and its effects on emerging market economies and beyond. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz joins us now from Shanghai. Morning, Rob.
Morning, David.
Declines in China's stock market have been a reoccurring theme this summer, but today the markets were in a kind of free fall. What happened?
Well, I think part of this is cyclical. You know, Friday's terrible day on the New York Stock Exchange, which was in part a reaction to last week's poor performance in the markets here in China, I think had an effect. So there's a bit of a global market feedback loop going on here. Another reason for today's crash is that Chinese investors have been holding out hope that China's central bank would come to the rescue by injecting more liquidity into the banking system, essentially giving banks more money to make loans. But that hasn't happened yet. So there's a lot of fear that China's government, which time and time again has stepped in when the market has gone south, isn't going to continue to do that.
But at the same time, China's government's not going to just stand there and watch the market collapse.
Well, you know, today it certainly did. But, you know, we're hearing rumors the central bank may inject more money into the system as early as next month. And not only that, but over the weekend, Beijing announced a new rule that allows the managers of China's massive pension fund to invest up to nearly $100 billion worth of its citizens' pensions into China's stock market. You know, that will obviously be a nice financial boost to the market, but it seems like a desperate attempt to prop it up. And I'm not sure how comfortable the Chinese people will be with the government putting their pensions into a stock market that's been this volatile.
Now, this decline in Shanghai today is going to make market players on Wall Street, what's the word, uncomfortable when they wake up.
Yeah. You know, I think people are worried things are about to get very ugly on Wall Street. I spoke to Ann Stevenson Yang about this today. She's an analyst for J Capital Research, and here's how she thinks all of this will impact the U.S. economy.
There are, you know, immediate short-term effects like a decline in earnings for international companies that derive profit from China, a decline in export earnings for companies that export to China, and people are going to be reassessing China's ability to pay its debts. All sorts of things.
But I think it's important to add that she and many other China economists are more hopeful about how the U.S. economy will fare in the long run, despite this Chinese slowdown.
Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, David.
Economists far and wide see the market turbulence as a reason that U.S. interest rates should not be raised next month, as had been the expectation. Whether or not the guardians of interest rates at the Federal Reserve agree with this view is another question. Money is seeking perceived safe havens today, including U.S. government bonds, with the 10-year Treasury yield down dramatically at 1.95%.
Marketplace is supported by TIAA CREF, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA CREF, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by LegalZoom, resources to help protect intellectual property, including trademark, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Earlier this summer, Chicago police arrested a group of men for taking over 14 vacant foreclosed homes, living in some and renting out the rest. Most of these homes were in prosperous neighborhoods. 7 years after the housing market crashed, there are still enough vacant homes to provide opportunities for this kind of creativity. Marketplace's Dan Weissman investigates.
Eight of these houses were in Beverly and Morgan Park, South Side Chicago neighborhoods that look like suburbs. Big brick houses, winding streets, and a super active neighborhood group, the Beverly Area Planning Association. One of the homes was a block and a half from the group's office. Margot Holland, the executive director, walked there with me.
It's a beautiful block. It's tree-lined and...
What's this across the street? Is that a park? Is that a mansion?
What is it? It's a home.
So this is like a castle here. And somewhere here, there's a home that was occupied.
Yeah.
I think over there?
I do. Do you have the exact address?
I do.
That's what I thought.
It's this house right here?
Yeah.
Right next to the mansion. Oh, and it fits right in. Landscaping looks great. So how does a tidy home on a beautiful block end up ripe for the picking?
I asked Rob Rose for help looking up public records that could tell the story. He runs the Cook County Land Bank, created to help clear a backlog of vacant foreclosed properties. He's working with a list of 23,000 tax-delinquent parcels. And I asked him, how long would it take him to deal with them all?
Oh, the rest of my life.
He's done this math. He thinks 500 a year would be a pretty good clip. That's 46 years. And here's the thing. From the records we find, none of these eight properties are among his 23,000.
This is the most difficult kind of property to get to because there's no immediate red flags.
The taxes are paid, probably by the lender. For the house next to the mansion, records show foreclosure started 3 years ago, but the lender hasn't taken title. That's about average in Illinois, which has more protections for homeowners. Darren Bloomquist is vice president of RealtyTrack, a real estate analytics company.
The longer it's in that process, the better chance that the homeowner is just leaving the property and walking away and leaving it vacant.
Nationally, RealtyTrack counts about 127,000 of these zombie properties. Compared to the national housing market, 2 million homes?
It really is a drop in the bucket. I think really this is a neighborhood issue.
But even in a nice neighborhood, a few zombies here and there can provide an opening for creative operators. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
Both on the air and at marketplace.org, we'll be following what is now day three of the surge downward in stock prices around the world. The S&P 500 is currently down about 4.25%, and the Dow is down 3.9%. That's a drop of 648 points. Coming to you today from Montclair State University in New Jersey, as our New York Bureau gets an overhaul, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's more news for you throughout the day with headlines from NPR and WPR at noon, All Things Considered from 3 to 6:30, and stories to listen to, read, and comment on anytime at WPR.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at VeroInternationalCuisine.com. You're listening to WGTD HD,